S-P-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's Scintillating Science Monday, understand something. You know how I love my science envoys, and Wonderfest keeps giving me great ones, and I've got another one for you here today to welcome in the new year. I'd like to welcome Chinmay Sonowane. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
So before we get into the science of it, what I really want to know is, when did you get bitten with the science bug?
That's a good question. I think the first time that I truly thought about, you know, wow, science, this is something I could do, was probably in year 11 of high school.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we had this assignment, and we had to write an essay given this prompt. The prompt was venom, friend or foe.
Venom?
And venom. Mm-hmm. Venom, spider venom, animal venom in general.
Mm-hmm.
And the prompt was really getting at this idea of, you know, all of these venoms can certainly have a harmful effect on your body, which is why it might be a foe. But venom is also used in medicine. And although I don't work on any kind of animal venom today, it was the first time that I think I realized that we conserve wildlife, not just because, you know, a select few people in the world decide that's what they want to do, but because there are very tangible benefits to having animals around us today. So I think that assignment really prompted me to think more deeply about the wildlife around us, which something I was already passionate about,
mm-hmm.
and I imagine a lot of other people are passionate about, and think more about how these wildlife are actually benefiting us in our everyday life.
So this essay got you thinking about it, and then as you go into college, do you start immediately into the sciences, or did you get there through a circuitous route?
Yeah, so I think after I'd written that essay, in my mind, what I really wanted to do was study venom at the time. So I was thinking I was going to do some sort of science. I didn't know at the time that you could be a scientist in the same sense that, you know, researchers or professors are doing research today. But in my mind, what I wanted to do was collect snakes out in the outback, Australia and places in Asia, collect their venom, take that back to the lab, and study exactly what the therapeutic properties of these venoms are. That didn't really pan out during college. I got more and more interested in charismatic species that the people around us find particularly attractive and interesting, large wildlife in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, that's when I was also starting to get more exposed to life just beyond me and my group of friends as well. I think that's when I was getting more and more exposed to all of the current events, news, etc. And so I think in college, that's the first time I really had to think about how can we make wildlife matter to people. All of this really came together, I think, at the end of my senior year, when I was writing my senior thesis. And for that thesis, we were describing how hyenas, by scavenging around urban areas, are actually reducing disease in people.
That's pretty amazing. So I like how you talk about charismatic species. Like whenever you think of Australia, you think of the adorable koala bears, and, you know, you think of the continent of Africa, you think of elephants and giraffes, you know, all over the world you think of the super cute animals, but you call them charismatic. And what do they call the animals who do not have the good fortune of being charismatic.
I unfortunately don't think there's a suitable term for those kind of species. If these kind of species do cause problems for people, so snakes, I mean, you can consider snakes to be charismatic if you'd like to, but of course they also have a harmful effect on people as well. Sometimes these species are referred to as problematic species.
Oh, okay. All right. So you go through college, you do your paper on hyenas and how they reduce disease. Then where do you go?
Yeah, so I did that paper. You know, we focused on a particular species, the spotted hyena, and in a very particular locality, we were looking at northern Ethiopia, which is in East Africa. And I decided to go to grad school and pursue a PhD because I really enjoyed that research process and being able to communicate that science to the people that it matters to the most. So as a result of now joining a PhD program here at Stanford University, my advisor, Rudolfo Diezo, encouraged me to think about this benefit that hyenas might be providing to people on a more global scale.
Okay.
And now we're starting to think about how large scavengers, you know, so your hyenas, your all your different sorts of cats and dogs, so lions, wolves, bears, as well as your large avian scavengers, your large bird scavengers like vultures. How do these species provide similar health benefits to people? So at the moment, we're documenting exactly how, you know, this specific case of a health benefit in Ethiopia is not just an isolated case, but rather all of us, even in the Bay Area, might be experiencing the benefits of scavengers globally.
So talk a little bit more about your research and talk about the benefits besides just preventing disease, because you will hear about, oh, someone spotted a bobcat near a bus stop and you think, oh, that's terrible. But they're actually sort of useful reasons for them to be around. So go ahead and talk about that sort of that interaction.
Exactly, yeah. So this, we'll probably need to take a couple of steps back.
We've got to
realize that many of our wildlife are disappearing today. When we see plant species disappear, we typically refer to this as deforestation. And my advisor really pioneered this term called defaunation, which refers to when we see animal species disappear. So you can look at a forest and say, you know, that forest is deforested, but you could also say that forest is defaunated to refer to the loss of a species. Now, what we're asking is, what does it mean for people if we lose our big scavengers? And again, the same sort of scavengers that I mentioned earlier, vultures, hyenas, lions, bears, even in our marine ecosystems. Scavengers such as sharks are all disappearing today. And what we're seeing is that it's having two major detrimental effects on human health. One is, of course, that these scavengers, given that they are disappearing, there's less meat or less carcass waste that's being consumed. And this carcass waste is an ideal breeding ground for disease, because this is where pathogens use the resources in that animal matter and use that to multiply and even mutate into more lethal variants. So a lot of this carcass waste isn't being eaten up by wildlife, and that then harbors disease, which can spread to people. The other interesting thing that we're observing is that because we're losing our large scavengers, a lot of smaller scavengers are starting to pop up. So you might start to notice, you know, foxes, coyotes around, raccoons, particularly here in the Bay. And many of these species are fantastic and they can support human health by consuming carcasses, but there are a few individual species that might be, as I said, that might be actually problematic. So in parts of Africa, in parts of Asia, what we're seeing is when we lose large scavengers, mm-hmm. animals such as feral dogs explode.
Mm.
And then people have actually documented the uptick in rabies cases as a result of these invasive or problematic species popping up.
Okay, so can you give me an example of a large species that has disappeared and the other animals that elevated in terms of population? And also, too, when large species disappear, do other smaller animals that maybe had a symbiotic relationship with them, do they also start disappearing?
That's an excellent point. So I'll start with an example, and then I'll touch on your second point about the symbiotic relationship that you mentioned.
Okay.
I think what I think is the most tragic but the best example of this phenomenon occurred in India in the 1990s and in the 2000s. During that time, a lot of farmers were using particular drugs in their cattle treat disease.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and inevitably these cattle would die and the carcass would be left out. Now, the main animal that would clean up these carcasses were vultures.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the drug that was given to these cattle, vultures started disappearing rapidly. So much so that by the around 2005, India had lost about 95% of its vulture population.
Wow.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so people definitely notice this. I mean, if you walk around and you look up and you don't see the same sort of birds as you normally did in the last 10 years,
mm-hmm.
It's very clear. But what people then noticed was millions of more dogs were starting to pop up across India. And of course, these dogs were attracted to all of the carcass waste
mm-hmm.
that wasn't consumed. And then finally, around 2010, there was a really interesting study that connected the loss of vultures to the uptick in dog populations.
Mm-hmm.
And they also used health records to show that millions of more dog bites mm. occurred. And, of course, rabies cases followed. And what they ultimately correlated to the vulture decline was that around 50,000 more people had died as a result of rabies because these vultures had disappeared and the dogs had rebounded in their population. So that I think, is a well-documented example of what the loss of large and important scavengers can have
mm-hmm.
on human health.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's just one place. We're starting to see vultures disappearing in parts of Africa as well. And there are reports that dogs, feral dogs, are on the rise over there. And we can imagine similar sorts of issues as well. Your second question was the symbiotic relationship between large scavengers and smaller scavengers.
Mm-hmm.
When we do like a simple calculation of, you know, how many big scavengers there are
mm-hmm.
and how much they eat, they actually can contribute very little to removing carcass waste. So as an example, if we say that 20% of species or scavenging species are large scavengers,
okay,
they might only be eating 2 or 3% of all of the waste. And so what that calculation is suggesting is that maybe large scavengers don't actually matter that much because of how much they eat. But when we look at the studies, what all of these studies are showing is that when large scavengers disappear,
mm-hmm.
the amount of carcass waste that's behind actually increases dramatically. And that's because of this symbiotic relationship that you mentioned. When you have large scavengers, they actually facilitate smaller scavengers, in the sense that if you have a lion and it opens up a giraffe carcass and mm-hmm. that giraffe has had some disease, for example, mm-hmm. what that means is now smaller scavengers who couldn't penetrate the skin mm-hmm. of that giraffe mm-hmm. can now clean up that carcass as well. So there are important facilitation interactions between large and small scavengers.
Now, would mice and rats be included in the group of small scavengers?
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. So I've talked a little bit about the rise of, you know, free-ranging or feral dogs, mm-hmm. but something that I think we all know and notice is the rise of rodents. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there hasn't been much work done in relating the loss of large scavengers to these rodents, but it's certainly an issue that the world faces globally.
Got it. So when you talk about feral dogs and the increase or the increase of smaller scavengers in general, is the reason why they're increasing because there's less competition, or are they increasing because those scavengers would be a threat to them physically?
Yeah. So they're increasing for two reasons. One of them is related to competition. If there's less competition, then they're more likely to succeed in a given environment. Mm-hmm. And competition can be both, you know, it can be indirect in the sense that now there's more food available to these smaller scavengers. Mm-hmm. And it can also be direct in that large scavengers will actively attack or predate on small scavengers. Mm-hmm. But I think the other big mechanism driving the rise of these small scavengers is people. We put out a substantial amount of waste across our livestock system. So currently, today, mm-hmm. There's significantly much more livestock biomass than there are wild animals. Okay. And if you imagine every year, you know, a lot of these livestock are killed and parts of them are thrown away, or even these livestock might die by some sort of natural cause. They might be left to rot in a given environment. That mm-hmm. these livestock provide a lot of material for animals to feed upon. Okay. In our marine ecosystems, there's also a lot of waste being thrown away there by fishing vessels. A lot of bycatch, a lot of discard that's thrown away. Mm-hmm. And the animals that are best suited to capitalizing on these human food subsidies are actually smaller scavengers. You know, if any one of us saw a mountain lion strolling through the streets of San Francisco, mm-hmm. we'd be quite worried about that. But if we see a rat, see a mouse, we see a raccoon, we're going to be more tolerant of these smaller scavengers. So, yes, these smaller scavengers are on the rise because they're facing less competition, but also because they're better adapted to people and the food people provide to these scavengers.
Got it. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's touching your mind right now? Chinmay Sonowane is a PhD student at Stanford University, and his research addresses how biodiversity, conservation, and human development can go hand in hand. I want to go back to the example that you gave of India and finding out that the whatever they're feeding the livestock was contributing to the decimation of the vultures. When that came out, were there any moves made to rectify the situation, or was there a tremendous amount of resistance?
Yeah, I think it took quite a bit of work from the scientific community to demonstrate that it was this drug in particular that's mm-hmm. administered to livestock that caused the decline in vultures. So eventually the Indian government did ban the use of that drug in livestock, but that drug is still used for humans. And of course, if it's still available on the market, then it can still be informally used by farmers to treat their livestock as well. So it's still a reoccurring problem, even though there have been legal changes.
Mm-hmm.
But the positive news is that in the last 5 to 10 years, we are very slowly starting to see an increase in vultures.
Okay.
Not compared to the numbers that we saw, before the 1990s, but a positive trend in that they are increasing.
Okay. Well, what does it take, like how much of an effort and how much of a push would it take to, once you realize that this species is integral to the health of humans, what kind of effort would it take to try and get them back to close to where they were before the before that drug was introduced?
So on the one hand, you would have to eliminate the source of the problem, which is the use of this drug in livestock, and which has, by the looks of things, considerably reduced. It'd be ideal if we could completely eliminate it and prevent scavengers from consuming that drug.
Mm-hmm.
But the next thing that it takes is active restoration. One of my lab mates works on rewilding, and this is an idea of taking species from an area where they're thriving
mm-hmm.
and bringing them back into an area where they're not doing so well or that they've completely disappeared. And so she has worked across a number of different ecosystems. She's currently working in a particular set of forests in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And she's brought back animals like howler monkeys, and currently she's working with tapirs and tortoises. And it's a fairly intensive process. A lot of these species that we're talking about are, as we've discussed, they're big.
Mm-hmm.
They take a long time to grow. They might not reproduce every year, so very slow times to reproduce. And it requires a lot of active management and monitoring of these species. We've arrived at this point not just because some bad actions that have occurred over a couple of months or a couple of years, but really been hundreds of years of negative impacts by particular groups of people. And given how long of a negative impact we've had, we shouldn't expect the solutions to also take a few days or a few months or even a few years. It's going to take quite a bit of time to support the wildlife and bring them back to the numbers that we previously saw.
Got it. So when I think about these large scavengers and the benefit that they provide, I also think about how intimidating and dangerous a lot of them are. So how do you balance trying to reintroduce or rewild in places that are urban areas or urban adjacent so that people can still feel safe walking around?
Yeah, and I think this is where going back to that hyena example in Ethiopia might be useful.
Mm-hmm.
Hyenas are, before I started doing this research, I had no idea how big a hyena was.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first night that I saw a hyena, a juvenile actually came up to me within arm's reach, and it was much larger than a German Shepherd, even though it was a juvenile hyena.
Oh, wow.
So, of course, they're large animals, and people in the town that I was working in called Makale are very cautious of these animals.
Mm-hmm.
But they've lived alongside these animals for at least the last few hundred years, if not thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these people recognize the benefits of these hyenas. They recognize that these hyenas, they come into the city at night and they actually clean up much of the waste that's being thrown away. Butchers will even throw out any waste that they have just out onto the street to feed these hyenas. And so there are attacks on people every now and then, and it's a real tragedy, and at times it does inspire hatred towards these animals. But for the most part, there is a healthy level of tolerance because of the recognition of the benefits that these wildlife provide. And I think we need to do a much better job of being able to recognize and understand the benefits that wildlife around the world provide to us. And once we start to, recognize that deer and elk here in California benefit us, or mountain lions benefit us, perhaps we might be more tolerant and accepting of their presence.
Well, let me ask you this then. Is there a difference in the approach to, or the prevalence of large scavengers in wealthy areas versus low-income areas?
That's something that we're trying to understand a little bit deeper. At the moment, with the research that we're doing, we can certainly see in places like East Africa and South Africa, many of these places which are designated as low-income or middle-income countries, there is a higher diversity or richness of scavenging species. But also in North America, particularly in the eastern part of the U.S., we see a very diverse group of scavengers. I do think that the benefits will disproportionately benefit either low-income or rural areas where our health and medical infrastructure is still quite lacking. So perhaps the benefits are disproportionately distributed.
So then tell me a little bit more about what you hope to gain or what you hope to illuminate through the research that you're doing.
I think much of it is, it goes back to my first point when I was talking about the assignment that I had in year 11. I think at that point, I assumed that people were protecting wildlife just because they're beautiful to look at and that we enjoy seeing them. But the shift, the mindset shift that I'd like to see is that we're protecting these animals not just because they're beautiful to look at, but because it's in our collective interest to protect them. These animals do provide very tangible benefits to our health, to our economy. They might also be addressing equity issues within our society. And so eventually I think when we start to recognize all of these benefits that wildlife can provide to us, we'll feel much more motivated to actually conserve them.
Okay. Are there any places in the world where the large scavengers are at relatively the same levels that they've always been, or is there sort of a universal decline?
I can't think of a single place where they haven't declined. We have to keep in mind that the benefits that these scavengers provide, they can only provide these benefits in areas where there are people and where there are those scavengers, of course. Okay. Typically, not with all communities, but typically people might engage in activities that might destroy the habitat of these scavengers. People might be hunting these scavengers. So it's quite rare, at least up until now, to see strong coexistence, the strong benefits that people provide the scavengers to the point where these scavengers are thriving.
Well, are there any Are there any people on the, I guess the question that I have, I can see how if you are working on a grassroots level to raise awareness about the effect that the drugs and the cattle have on the overall species, you might have some push. But is there anything on a public policy level, like on a governmental level, where agencies are saying, okay, this is what we're going to do collectively, or is there just tremendous pushback?
I think the really exciting thing that we're starting to see is the idea of nature-based solutions to societal challenges. A lot of these nature-based solutions tend to focus on how entire ecosystems benefit people.
Mm-hmm.
So one example of this is how mangrove ecosystems protect cities from things like storm surges, mm-hmm. from hurricanes, cyclones, etc. So there's evidence of large ecosystems providing benefits to people, and there's been a lot of interest around that. I hope we can start to get the same sort of interest on a finer scale to understand how individual species might be benefiting people. And regarding these nature-based solutions, these are now implemented across different NGOs, across different governments. So hopefully we can start to see the benefits of species implemented under the same umbrella of nature-based solutions.
Okay. So in the course of your research, have you come across any findings that surprised you or blew your mind?
I think what I found, and it shouldn't surprise me at all when I think back at it, it's much of the research that's published, quite a bit of this is actually very well known by the people who are living in these places.
Mm-hmm.
So again, going back to the example in Ethiopia, the particular town that I was working in, people have known that hyenas provide this benefit. They've known this because this is their lived reality, and it's also their evolutionary history. Their people have grown up with hyenas around them.
Mm-hmm.
So in many of these cases, this knowledge is actually very well known locally. And so it's the hope of research to then share these interactions that people have at a local scale,
mm-hmm.
and start to see if we can foster these same sort of interactions in other parts of the world.
Well, that brings to mind that there's, I would say, a certain amount of chauvinism in the way that larger countries will go in and sort of and traditionally discount what the locals will say because they're different. So how do you combat that chauvinism?
I think fortunately in wildlife science, they've getting more and more recognition of the value of local knowledge,
mm-hmm.
of the knowledge of indigenous peoples, because ultimately these people are doing science in the same way that Western or traditional scientists might be doing their science.
Mm-hmm.
They too have learnt everything that they've learned through trial and error,
mm-hmm.
Either through a short period of time or often through a very long period of time, through decades or centuries of trial and error with the place that they are living in.
Okay.
I'm optimistic that we're starting to see more and more symbiosis,
mm-hmm.
more and more collaboration between people who live in these contexts, as well as people who might be living in foreign contexts.
Now, are there any pieces of information, local lore, that have been gathered that you wouldn't necessarily, that surprise you? That only by being in that community would you be able to say with any type of authority, this is going on, because it's not something that's readily observable?
mind expanding on that a little bit?
Sure. Like, let's say, for example, I saw this article where they were talking about some people went into a village and they wanted to build vegetables in a particular place, and the villagers just let them do it. And then the hippos came in and destroyed it all. And the villagers were like, yeah, they do that all the time. And but it was something that the people who came in just really had no knowledge of. And the only way you can gain that information is sort of cyclically and locally.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good question. Again, going back to Ethiopia, we came across a number of challenges with our methods. Mm-hmm. In particular, we were trying to measure exactly how much does a single hyena eat. And we, you know, tried a different methods, including we'd tie a piece of meat with a rope and then tie it to a tree or something solid. And what we found was what the hyenas would do is they would just either rip the meat off the rope and take it away, or they would just chew through the rope regardless of how thick the rope was.
Uh-huh.
So the only real way to observe how much they're eating is to be out in an open area, be parked up in a vehicle within a distance that you can still see the hyenas, but far enough so that they don't feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And in that open area, they're having to eat there. But of course, I still need to go out and weigh the leftovers of what they've eaten. And often, once they've eaten, what they do is they just lie down and sleep there. So it became difficult to retrieve that meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then two pieces of observations or information that I came across that helped me to eventually be able to measure how much they eat. One is that in particular parts of Africa, when people have hunted or currently hunt for meat,
mm-hmm.
one thing that they might do is they might scavenge off predators. So if a lion or a group of lions has made a kill,
mm-hmm.
What these people might do is they might approach the group of lions with their zebra kill very confidently, and the lions are shocked, so they'll run off, and these people will then cut off a leg and then take that to cook and eat.
Wait. I just want to make sure I understand. So you're saying that lions have taken down a zebra, and then the people come, they just show up, and the lions are like, whoa, and they bug out, and the people are like, mine now?
Exactly.
Okay.
I don't encourage anyone to try this or
no.
do this. But again, this knowledge has been built through a shared evolutionary history. We know through a lot of archaeological remains that people and large predators, particularly in parts of Africa,
mm-hmm.
Would conflict because either the person or the predator would make a kill. And the other would try and steal it off them. But the takeaway that I got from this piece of information was that if you approach an animal very confidently
mm-hmm.
and you look like you know what you're doing, they will run off.
Really?
And
even wow.
And I saw the same thing happening in Ethiopia as well. We'd be working at night because the hyenas are nocturnal.
Uh-huh.
And on our way to the sites that we worked at, sometimes farmers would have to walk to get to their house or get to their field.
Uh-huh.
And the way that they'd walk is they'd have a big rock in one of their hands and they'd just confidently walk. Even if there were a group of hyenas there, they'd confidently walk almost at a marching pace.
Wow.
And the hyenas would just scatter, allowing the person to get back home.
That's such a baller move.
Exactly.
Wow. So just having, you know, just having a cocksureness about your walk, and the animals are like, you know, give that person wide berth. That I would never have thought of that. I would just be terrified walking from point A to point B that a lion would take me down at any given second.
I think it's extraordinary that, you know, animals can read our body language like that. And I'm sure subconsciously when we encounter, you know, a large animal on a hiking trail or something like that, we also read their body language to try and understand what their intentions are as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. So perhaps there is some sort of common language that we can use to communicate with wildlife. But I'm going on a tangent here. Sure. So we can return to the actual.
No, I'm really impressed by just sort of faking confidence to survive. That's kind of a reflection of sort of the human existence. It's just fake it and hope they don't kill you.
It's a reflection of my PhD experience as well, you know. Just try and fake my confidence until I can actually gain it for myself.
Got it. So, well, then let me ask you this. Like, do you personally have a predator that you is just sort of your favorite? Like, every time you see it, you just think, or scavengers, I mean. Like, whenever I see I get annoyed with squirrels, but when I see them, I just think, oh my God, you're so cute. I can't possibly be mad at you.
I was born in Delhi, but my family originally is from central India. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of cultural ties as well as origin stories related to tigers. And so growing up, I always remember seeing a lot of tiger imagery mm-hmm. around the homes of my grandparents. So I think culturally, the tiger is a very important animal to my people. Mm-hmm. But my personal story, or the closest I've gotten to a tiger, was this was maybe several years ago. I was living in Cape Town at the time. Mm-hmm. And growing up, I'd never had any pets. And so I just moved into this new place in Cape Town. And I'd leave my window open every day because, you know, sometimes it can be boiling hot. Mm-hmm. And very early on, must have been the first or second week, at night time, this street cat would just come and sleep on my bed every single day. And it's the closest I've ever gotten to having a pet. It's a cat. Somewhat related to tigers, I guess. Mm-hmm. But that is probably my fondest experience with an animal. Just being able to have what I thought was a wild animal feeling comfortable in my room, in my home at the time.
Did it let you pet it, or did it just simply tolerate your existence?
Oh, yeah, it was very, very comfortable. It took a few weeks for it to come close enough for me to pet. But when it did, it felt very much like a normal house cat.
Got it. So through, what is the point that you really want to people to take away from the research that you're doing, and just, you know, just from a personal level, what is it that you really want people, you want to really stress for people to understand?
In a few short words, it's that wildlife do benefit us. And if we move beyond the scavengers, and I'll try and make it more relevant to the Bay Area, for example, mm-hmm. We know we have a population of mountain lions in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Mm-hmm. One of the observed and documented benefits of animals like mountain lions is that they actually prevent car accidents. They prevent car accidents because they are killing deer and eating deer. And so that means that there's less deer vehicle accidents on our roads every day. This is well documented in other parts of US. It's particularly well documented with animals like wolves, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's a very local tip that I hope that your listeners can also start to appreciate as well.
Okay. So if people if people want to find out more about the type of research that you're doing, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, they can look up our lab website, which is my advisor's name is Rudolf Peduzzo at Stanford University. Mm-hmm. And you'll find all of the wonderful research that my lab and particularly my lab mates do on that website.
And then are there any, because I know people have kids who, and you know how kids sort of, kids are really into predators and things like that. What would you recommend as a good book to learn more about scavengers or predators?
I think what might be even more fascinating to the younger audience mm-hmm. is Planet Earth. There's been a fantastic new season that just came out a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Planet Earth has existed for, I think, a couple of decades now. But with each season, they're using all of these new technologies to document the lives and the behavior and also the interactions of these animals with people in just such a fascinating way. So I'd highly encourage younger people to certainly check out documentaries like Planet Earth.
Well, Chinmay Sonowane, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, and I'm still reeling about just being able to just kind of stare down an apex predator to go from point A to point B. That's the one that's going to stick with me for a while. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
All right, people of Earth. These large scavengers, the small scavengers, they all have a place in our ecosystem.
Look here, you animals, do as I say, I'm in charge here. Jump! I said jump! Plié! Arabesque! Do you hear me? You're big and you're daft and you're worth nothing more than a fistful of peanuts swept up from the floor, and you're hey diddle diddle dee fiddle dee diddle dee do.
What's that you say?
Hey diddle.
Soon you will see. Ha! I'll serve you my knuckle sandwich with crumpets and tea. Yes, I'll feed it to you in my pachyderm glee and my hey diddle diddle dee fiddle dee diddle dee doo. A crumpet stampede.
Hey diddle dee fiddle dee diddle dee diddle dee doo.
How'd you like to see a death wish, a tippy-toe rhinoceros upon the precipice of gloom and doom? She was not created for your amusement or your voyeuristic thrill. It sends a chill down your erectus homo sapien spine. I'm just a man, but I might understand if you'd show me. Show me the ways of your nights and your days beneath feathers and of your potion, a nip of your brew, and your hey diddle diddle dee fiddle dee diddle dee doo.
What's that you say?
Hey diddle dee fiddle dee diddle dee diddle dee doo.
Scatter the ashes and shatter the bones of the captain.
Hey, throw down the bones.
Shiver the
How'd you like to see a death wish, a tippy-toe rhinoceros upon the precipice of gloom and doom? She was not created for your amusement or your voyeuristic thrill. It sends a chill down your erectus homo sapien spine.
To save all my bread. Quit chasing these pretty girls and talking out loud, and always trying to draw me one of them New York crowds. Going to stop my landlady from always singing the blues, and each and every week I intend to pay my rently dues. Well, for the first few blacks you do it upright, then you wonder what is happening on the scene tonight. You lamp your bread and you ease out a pound. Now you know that's gonna cool you, cause you ain't going for but a round. Well, there's old Tommy and Willie and my man Cal and old Sud Bustin' Francis trying to act like she is a glamour gal. They ask you, where you been, man? We ain't seen you of late. But you must have hit the sweepstakes, cause you sure are looking great. Well, now you know these folks is jiving and stiffing, but vanity being your case, yeah, everything is cool. You folks come on up and have a taste. Well, you forget about time while your friends tell you about the past, but you fail to dig that your pound has been splitting very fast. Say, who is that little chick with the hat box, you know, with the long black hair? I mean the one that's standing pretty over there. Well, man, that's old New York Sadie, and she thinks she's real wise. But I'll cut you into her if you got great big eyes. Now, after a brief bit of conversation, you find she don't drink and she don't smoke. Now you know you gonna take this girl for the pure New York okie doke. Now just when everything is cool and you know this is about it, up come one of the Cadillac fellas and say, all right, baby, let's split. Now everything is a drag and you ready to quit the scene, cause your pound has flown and so has the queen.
I'm going to cut you loose, find someone else do. Baby, tell me, why do you do me like you do? oh baby. Time has expired for you. I fell for you at sight, not knowing if I was right. I brought you from the farm and gave you a beautiful home. Oh, baby, time has expired for you now. I know, I said I know you're going to regret it now. My very last dollar, I'm sure that I will bet it that you're gonna come back crying to my lonely heart. But I'll be sharing another's love and a woman tender charm. I got to put you back at the farm where I found you at. The things you do to me, you keep me in misery. Oh, baby, time has expired for you. I don't need you no more, baby. You once was my dad. I don't want you to be by my side. Go ahead on, baby. You got to move.
Come on. broadcasting locally on 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco and worldwide at KPOO.com.